leaned her head back against the wall, closing her eyes.
I guess you're giving me a heads up, huh? For telling everybody else my sister was gay?
Sarah was quiet then. I hadn't planned on putting that in my briefing.
I'll tell him, Lena decided, opening her eyes. Can you give me a minute?
Sure. Lena waited until Sarah had left the room, then put her head into her hands. She wanted to cry, but no tears would come. Her body was so dehydrated she was amazed she still had spit in her mouth. She took a deep breath to brace herself and stood. Frank Wallace and Matt Hogan were in the briefing room when she came out of the supply closet. Frank gave her a nod, but Matt made himself busy putting cream in his coffee. Both detectives were in their 50s, both from a very different time than the one Lena had grown up in. Like the rest of the detectives on the senior squad, they operated by the old rules of the police fraternity, where justice, at any cost, was right. The force was their family, and anything that happened to one of their officers affected them as it would a brother. If Grant was a close-knit community, the detectives were even closer. As a matter of fact, Lena knew that every one of her fellow detectives were members at the local lodge. Except for the simple matter of her not having a penis, she imagined she would have been invited to join a long time ago, if not out of respect, then obligation. She wondered what these two old men would think, knowing they were working a case to find out who had raped a lesbian. Once, a long time ago, Lena had actually heard Matt start a sentence with the words, "Back when the Klan was doing some good." Would they be as vigilant if they knew about Sybil? Or would their anger dissipate? Lena did not want to find out the hard way. Jeffrey was reading a report when she knocked on his open office door.
"Sarah gets you straightened out?"
he asked. She did not like the way he phrased his question, but Lena said yes anyway as she closed the door. Jeffrey was obviously surprised to see her close the door. He set aside the report and waited for her to sit down before asking,
"What's up?"
Lena felt the best thing to do was blurt it out. "My sister was a lesbian." Her words hung in the air over their heads like cartoons. Lena fought the urge to give a nervous laugh. She had never spoken them out loud before. Sybil's sexuality was something Lena was not comfortable talking about, even with her sister. When Sybil moved in with Nan Thomas a short year after moving to Grant, Lena had not pushed for details. She honestly had not wanted to know them.
"Well,"
Jeffrey said, his voice indicating surprise.
"Thank you for telling me that."
"Do you think it impacts the investigation?" Lena asked, wondering if this was all for nothing.
"I don't know,"
he answered, and she felt he was telling the truth.
"Has anyone been sending her threatening mail? Making disparaging remarks?"
Lena wondered about this too. Nan had said nothing new had happened in the last few weeks, but she also knew Lena was not open to discussing anything that might bring up the fact that Nan was fucking her sister.
"I guess you should talk to Nan."
"Nan Thomas?"
"Yeah," Lena said. "They live together. The address is on Cooper. Maybe we could go after the briefing?"
"Later today," he said. "Around 4?
Lena nodded her agreement. She couldn't stop herself from asking,
"Are you going to tell the guys?"
He seemed surprised by her question. After giving her a long look, he said,
"I don't think it's necessary at this stage. We'll talk to Nan tonight and go from there."
Lena felt an inordinate amount of relief. Jeffrey glanced at his watch.
"We'd better get to the briefing."
Chapter 9. Jeffrey stood at the front of the briefing room, waiting for Lena to come out of the bathroom. After their discussion, she had asked for a few minutes. He hoped she took the time to get herself together. Despite her temper, Lena Adams was a smart woman and a good cop. He hated to see her going through this alone. Jeffrey also knew that she would not have it any other way. Sarah sat in the front row, her legs crossed. She was wearing an olive-colored linen dress that fell to just above her ankles. Two slits came up either side of her legs, stopping just below her knees. Her red hair was pulled up into a ponytail behind her neck, like she had worn it to church on Sunday. Jeffrey remembered the expression on her face when she had noticed him sitting in the pew behind her and wondered if there would ever be a time in his life again when Sarah was actually pleased to see him. He had stared at his hands the entire service, biding his time, until he could slip out without causing too much commotion. Sarah Linton was what Jeffrey's father liked to call a tall drink of water. Jeffrey had been attracted to Sarah because of her strong will, her fierce independence. He liked her aloofness and the way she talked down to his football buddies. He liked the way her mind worked and the fact that he could talk about every aspect of his job and know she would understand. He liked that she couldn't cook and that she could sleep through a hurricane. He liked that she was a horrible house cleaner and that her feet were so big she could wear his shoes. What he really liked was that she knew all these things about herself and was actually proud of them. Of course, her independence had a downside. Even after 6 years of marriage, he wasn't sure he knew one damn thing about her. Sarah was so good at projecting a strong facade that, after a while, he wondered if she even needed him. Between her family, the clinic, and the morgue, there did not seem to be a whole lot of time left for Jeffrey. While he knew cheating on Sarah was not the best way to go about changing things, he did know that, at that point in time, something had to give in their marriage. He wanted to see her hurt. He wanted to see her fight for him and their relationship. That the first would happen, and not the latter, still kept his mind spinning. At times, Jeffrey was almost angry with Sarah that something so meaningless, something so stupid as a mindless sexual indiscretion, had broken up their marriage. Jeffrey leaned against the podium, his hands clasped in front of him. He pushed Sarah from his mind and concentrated on the task at hand. On the card table beside him was a 16-page list of names and addresses. All convicted sexual offenders living in or moving to the state of Georgia were required to register their name and address with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation's Crime Information Center. Jeffrey had spent last night and most of the morning compiling this information on the 67 Grant residents who had registered since the law was passed in 1996. Going through their crimes was a daunting task, not least of all because he knew that sexual predators were like cockroaches. For every one you saw, there were 20 more hiding behind the walls. He did not let his mind dwell on this as he waited to start the meeting. The briefing room was hardly filled to capacity. Frank Wallace, Matt Hogan, and five other detectives were part of the senior squad. Jeffrey and Lena rounded out this number to 9. Of the 9, only Jeffrey and Frank had worked in municipalities larger than Grant. Sybil Adams' killer certainly seemed to have better odds. Brad Stevens, a junior patrolman who, despite his youth and lack of rank, knew how to keep his mouth shut, stood just beside the door in case anyone tried to come in. Brad was a kind of mascot around the squad, and the fact that he still had most of his baby fat gave him a round, cartoonish appearance. His thin blonde hair always looked as if someone had just rubbed a balloon against it. His mother often brought his lunch to the station. He was a good kid, though. Brad had still been in high school when he contacted Jeffrey about being on the force. Like most of his younger cops, he came from Grant. His people were here. He had a vested interest in keeping the streets safe. Jeffrey cleared his throat for attention as Brad opened the door for Lena.
If anyone was surprised to see her there, they didn't say. She took a chair in the back, her arms crossed over her chest. Her eyes still red, either from her recent binge or from crying. Or from both.
"Thank you for coming on such short notice," Jeffrey began.
He gave Brad a nod, indicating that he should start circulating the 5 packets Jeffrey had put together earlier.
"Let me preface this by saying anything said in this room today should be treated as highly confidential information. What you hear today is not for general consumption, and any leaks could greatly impede our case."
He waited as Brad finished his rounds.
"I'm sure all of you know by now that Sybil Adams was killed yesterday at the filling station."
Nods came from the men who were not going through the copies. What he said next made them all look up.
"She was raped before she was killed."
There seemed to be a rise in the temperature of the room as he let this set in. These men were from different times. Women were as mysterious to them as the origins of the planet. Sybil's rape would galvanize them into action like nothing else. Jeffrey held up his copy of the list as Brad passed out the packets according to the names Jeffrey had written on the outside.
Jeffrey said, "I pulled this list of offenders off the computer this morning. I've sectioned them off to the usual teams, with the exception of Frank and Lena."
He saw her mouth open to complain, but continued,
"Brad will be working with you, Lena. Frank is with me."
Lena sat back in a defiant posture. Brad was hardly on her level, and her look said she knew exactly what he was doing. She would also realize, as soon as she interviewed the 3rd or 4th man on her list, that Jeffrey was keeping her on a tight leash. Rapists tended to attack women in their own ethnic and age group. Lena and Brad would be interviewing every minority over the age of 50 with a sexual assault on his record.
"Dr. Linton will give you the rundown on the specifics."
He paused, then,
"My first guess would be that the attacker has some kind of religious leaning, maybe a fanatic. I don't want that to be the focus of your questioning, but keep it in the back of your mind."
He stacked the papers on the podium.
"If somebody comes up that we should look at, I want a call on my radio. I don't want any suspect falling down in custody or accidentally getting his head blown off."
Jeffrey studiously avoided meeting Sarah's eyes as he said this last part. Jeffrey was a cop. He knew how things worked in the street. He knew that every man in this room had something to prove where Sybil Adams was concerned. He also knew how easy it was to slip over that line between legal justice and human justice when you were out in the field, facing down the kind of animal who could rape a blind woman and carve a cross onto her abdomen.
"That clear?"
he asked, not expecting an answer and not getting one.
"I'll turn this over to Dr. Linton, then."
He walked to the back of the room, standing behind and to the right of Lena, as Sarah took the podium. She walked over to the chalkboard, reached up, and pulled down the white projection screen. Most of the men in this room had seen her in diapers, and the fact that they all had their notebooks out said volumes about Sarah's professional abilities. She gave Brad Stevens a nod, and the room went dark. The green opaque projector whirred to life, sending a flash of bright light onto the screen. Sarah moved a photograph onto the bed and slid it under the glass. "Sybil Adams was found by me in the women's bathroom of the filling station around 2:30 yesterday afternoon," she said, focusing the projector's lens. There was movement in the room as a Polaroid of Sybil Adams lying partially nude on the bathroom floor came into view. Jeffrey found himself staring at the hole in her chest, wondering what kind of man could do the things that had been done to that poor young woman. He did not want to think about Sybil Adams, blind, sitting on that toilet while her attacker slit her open for his own sick reasons. He did not want to think about what was going through her mind as her abdomen was being raped. Sarah continued, "She was sitting on the toilet when I opened the door. Her arms and legs were splayed open, and the cut you see here," she indicated the screen, "was bleeding profusely.
Jeffrey leaned over slightly, trying to see what Lena's reaction to this was. She stood, stock still, her spine a perfect right angle to the floor. He understood why she needed to do this, but he could not grasp how she was doing it. If someone in his family had gone through this, if Sarah had been ravaged like this, Jeffrey knew in his heart that he would not want to know. He could not know. Sarah stood at the front of the room, her arms crossed over her chest. She started to seize shortly after I established that she had a pulse. We fell to the ground. I tried to control the seizures, but she expired several seconds later. Sarah jerked the projector's drawer out to replace the photo with another. The machine was a dinosaur, borrowed from the high school. It wasn't as if Sarah could send the crime photos down to the Jiffy photo for enlargements. The next picture that came on screen was a close-up of Sybil Adams' head and neck. The bruise under her eye came from a superior position, probably early on in the assault to discourage a struggle. A knife was held at her throat, very sharp, measuring about 6 inches. I'd say this was a boning knife, probably common to any kitchen. You can see a slight cut here. She traced her finger on the screen along the middle of Sybil's neck. It didn't draw blood, but enough pressure was used to score the skin. She looked up, catching Jeffrey's eye. I would imagine the knife was used to keep her from calling out while he raped her. She continued. There is a small bite mark on her left shoulder. The picture of this came up. Bite marks are common with rape. This one shows the impression of the upper teeth only. I found nothing distinctive in the pattern, but I've sent the... Sarah paused, probably remembering Lena was in the room. The impression was sent to the FBI lab for cross-matching. If a known offender on file matches the impression, then we could assume that he's the perpetrator in this crime. However, she warned, as we all know, the FBI won't consider this a high-priority case, so I don't think we can hang our hats on this piece of evidence. A more likely scenario would be to use the impression as validation after the fact. That is to say, find a solid suspect and nail him with the dental impression. Next, the screen showed a photograph of the inner sides of Sybil's legs. You can see the scrapes here at the knee where she gripped her legs around the toilet bowl during the assault. Another picture came, this one of Sybil's bottom. There are irregular bruises and scrapes on the buttocks, again from friction against the toilet seat. Her wrists, Sarah said, putting in another photo, show bruising from the handicap bars on the stall. Two fingernails were broken in the process of gripping the bars, probably to lift herself up and away from her assailant. Sarah slid in the next photograph. This is a close-up of the incisions to her abdomen, she narrated. The first cut was made from just below the collarbone all the way to the pelvic bone. The second cut was made from right to left. She paused. I would guess from the irregular depth of the second cut that this was a backhanded movement by a left-handed assailant. The cut is deeper as it moves to her right side. The next Polaroid was a close-up of Sybil's chest. Sarah was quiet for a few beats, probably thinking the same thing Jeffrey was thinking. Up close, he could see where the puncture wound had been stretched. Not for the first time, he felt his stomach roll at the thought of what was done to this poor woman. He hoped to God she had not been conscious of what was happening to her. Sarah said, "This is the final cut. It's a puncture wound through the sternum. It goes straight through to her spine. I would guess this was the source of most of the blood." Sarah turned to Brad. "Lights?" She walked toward her briefcase, saying, "The symbol on her chest seems to be a cross. The assailant used a condom during the rape, which, as we know, is pretty common with the advent of DNA testing. Black lighting revealed no sperm or fluids. Blood on the scene appears to be only from the victim." She took a sheet of paper out of her briefcase. "Our friends at the Georgia Bureau of Investigation were nice enough to pull some strings last night. They worked up the blood analysis for me." She put on her copper-rimmed glasses and began reading. High concentrations of hyoscyamine, atrozin, and belladonine, as well as traces of scopolamine, were found in her central blood and urine. She looked up. This would suggest that Sybil Adams ingested a lethal dose of belladonna, which belongs in the deadly nightshade plant family. Jeffrey glanced at Lena. She remained quiet, her eyes on Sarah. An overdose of belladonna can mimic a complete shutdown of the parasympathetic nervous system. Sybil Adams was blind, but her pupils were dilated from the drug. The bronchioles in her lungs were swollen. Her core body temperature was still high, which is what made me wonder about her blood in the first place. She turned to Jeffrey, answering the question he had asked this morning. During the post, her skin was still warm to the touch. There were no environmental factors that would cause this. I knew it had to be something in the blood. She continued. Belladonna can be broken down for medical applications, but it's also used as a recreational drug.
You think the perp gave it to her?
Jeffrey asked.
Or is this the kind of thing she would take on her own?
Sarah seemed to consider this. Sybil Adams was a chemist. She certainly wouldn't take such a volatile drug, then run out for lunch. This is a very strong hallucinogen. It affects the heart, breathing, and circulation.
Nightshade grows all over town,
Frank pointed out. It's pretty common, Sarah agreed, looking back at her notes. The plant isn't easy to process. Ingestion is going to be the key component here. According to Nick, the easiest and most popular way to take belladonna is to soak the seeds in hot water. Just this morning, I found 3 recipes on the internet for preparing belladonna as a tea. Lena offered. She liked to drink hot tea. There you go, Sarah said. The seeds are highly soluble. I imagine within minutes of drinking it, she would have started experiencing elevated blood pressure, heart palpitations, dry mouth, and extreme nervousness. I would also guess this led her to the bathroom, where her rapist was waiting for her. Frank turned to Jeffrey.
We need to talk to Pete Wayne. He served her lunch. He gave her the tea.
No way, Matt countered. Pete's lived in town all his life. This isn't the kind of thing he'd do.
Then, as if this was the most important thing in Pete's favor, Matt added,
He's in the lodge.
Murmurs came from the other men. Someone, Jeffrey wasn't sure who, said,
What about Pete's colored man?
Jeffrey felt a trickle of sweat run down his back. He could see where this was going already. He held up his hands for silence.
Frank and I will talk to Pete. You guys have your assignment. I want reports back at the end of the day.
Matt seemed about to say something, but Jeffrey stopped him.
We're not helping Sybil Adams by sitting in this room pulling theories out of our asses.
He paused, then indicated the packets Brad had handed out.
Knock on every goddamn door in town if you have to, but I want an accounting for every man on those lists.
As Jeffrey and Frank walked to the diner, the words, Pete's colored man, sat in the back of Jeffrey's mind like a piece of hot coal. The vernacular was familiar from his childhood, but he had not heard it used in at least 30 years. It amazed Jeffrey to see that such overt racism still existed. It also scared him that he had heard it in his own squad room. Jeffrey had worked in Grant for 10 years, but he was still an outsider. Even his southern roots didn't pay his dues into the good old boy club. Coming from Alabama didn't help matters. A typical prayer among southern states was, Thank God for Alabama. Meaning, thank God we're not as bad off as they are. This was part of the reason he was keeping Frank Wallace close at hand. Frank was part of these men. He was in the club. Frank shucked off his coat, folding it across his arm as he walked. He was tall and thin like a reed, with a face rendered unreadable from years of being a cop. Frank said,
This black guy, Will Harris. I got called in a few years back on a domestic dispute. He popped his wife.
Jeffrey stopped.
Yeah?
Frank stopped alongside him.
Yeah, he said. Beat her pretty bad. Busted her lip. When I got there, she was on the floor. She was wearing this cotton bag-looking kind of dress.
He shrugged.
Anyway, it was torn. You think he raped her?
Frank shrugged.
She wouldn't press charges.
Jeffrey started walking again.
Anybody else know about this? Matt, Frank said. He was my partner back then.
Jeffrey felt a sense of dread as he opened the door to the diner.
We're closed, Pete called from the back.
Jeffrey said,
It's Jeffrey, Pete.
He came out of the storeroom, wiping his hands on his apron.
Hey, Jeffrey, he said, nodding.
Then,
Frank.
We should be finished up in here this afternoon, Pete,
Jeffrey said.
You'll be able to open tomorrow.
Closing for the rest of the week,
Pete said as he retied his apron strings.
Don't seem right to be open, what with Sybil and all.
He indicated the row of stools in front of the bar.
Get y'all some coffee?
That'd be great, Jeffrey said, taking the first stool. Frank followed suit, sitting down beside him.
Jeffrey watched Pete walk around the counter and take out three thick ceramic mugs.
The coffee steamed as he poured it into the cups. Pete asked,
You got anything yet?
Jeffrey took one of the mugs.
Can you run through what happened yesterday? I mean, from the point Sybil Adams came into the restaurant.
Pete leaned back against the grill.
I guess she came in about 1:30, he said. She always came in after the lunch rush. I guess she didn't want to be poking around with her cane in front of all those people. I mean, we knew she was blind, sure, but she didn't like drawing attention to it. You could see that. She was kind of nervous in crowds.
Jeffrey took out his notebook, though he didn't really need it to take notes. What he did know was that Pete seemed to know a lot about Sybil Adams.
She come in here a lot? Every Monday, like clockwork.
He squinted his eyes, thinking.
I guess for the last 5 years or so. She came in sometimes late at night with other teachers or Nan from the library. I think they rented a house over on Cooper.
Jeffrey nodded.
But that was only occasionally. Mostly it was Mondays. Always by herself. She walked here, ordered her lunch, then was out by around 2 usually.
He rubbed his chin, a sad look coming over his face.
She always left a nice tip. I didn't think anything about it when I saw her table empty. I guess I just thought she had gone while I wasn't looking.
Jeffrey asked, What'd she order?
Same thing as always, Pete said. The number 3.
Jeffrey knew this was the waffle platter with eggs, bacon, and a side of grits.
Only, Pete clarified, she didn't eat meat, so I always left off the bacon. And she didn't drink coffee, so I gave her some hot tea.
Jeffrey wrote this down.
What kind of tea?
He rooted around behind the counter and pulled out a box of generic brand tea bags.
I picked it up for her at the grocery store. She didn't drink caffeine.
He gave a small laugh.
I like to make her comfortable, you know. She didn't get out much. She used to say to me that she liked coming here, that she felt comfortable.
He fiddled with the box of tea.
What about the cup she used?
Jeffrey asked.
I don't know about that. They all look the same.
He walked to the end of the counter and pulled out a large metal drawer. Jeffrey leaned over to look inside. The drawer was actually a large dishwasher filled with cups and plates. Jeffrey asked,
Those from yesterday?
Pete nodded.
I can't begin to guess which one was hers. I started the washer before she was...
He stopped, looking down at his hands.
My dad. He always told me to take care of the customers and they'd take care of you.
He looked up, tears in his eyes.
She was a nice girl, you know. Why would anybody want to hurt her? I don't know, Pete, Jeffrey said. Mind if we take this?
He pointed to the box of tea. Pete shrugged.
Sure. Nobody else drank it.
The laugh came again.
I tried it once just to see. Tasted like brown water.
Frank pulled a tea bag out of the box. Each bag was wrapped and sealed in a paper envelope. He asked,
Was old Will working here yesterday?
Pete seemed taken aback by the question.
Sure, he's worked lunch every day for the last 50 years. Comes in about 11, leaves by 2 or so.
He studied Jeffrey.
He does odd jobs for people around town after he leaves here. Mostly yard work, some light carpentry.
He busses tables here?
Jeffrey asked, though he had eaten enough lunches in the diner to know what Will Harris did.
Sure, Pete said. Busses tables, mops the floors, takes people their food.
He gave Jeffrey a curious look.
Why? No reason,
Jeffrey answered, leaning over. He shook the man's hand, saying,
Thanks, Pete. We'll let you know if we need anything else.
Chapter 10 Lena traced her finger along the street map in her lap.
Left here, she told Brad.
He did as he was told, steering the cruiser onto Baker Street. Brad was okay, but he tended to take people at face value, which is why, back at the station when Lena said she had to go to the bathroom, then headed the exact opposite direction of the women's room, he hadn't said anything. A joke around the station house was to hide Brad's patrolman's hat from him. At Christmas, they had stuck it on top of one of the reindeer on display in front of City Hall. A month ago, Lena had spotted the hat on top of the statue of Robert E. Lee in front of the high school. Lena knew Jeffrey partnering her with Brad Stevens was his way of keeping her at the periphery of the investigation. If she had to guess, she would say that every man on their list was either dead or too old to stand up without help. The next ride, she said, folding the map. She had sneaked into Marla's office and looked up Will Harris's address in the phone book during her alleged trip to the bathroom. Jeffrey would interview Pete first. Lena wanted a crack at Will Harris before her chief could get to him.
Right here, Lena said, indicating he could pull over. You can stay here.
Brad slowed the car, putting his fingers to his mouth.
What's the address?
431. She said, spotting the mailbox. She slipped off her seatbelt and opened her door before the car came to a complete stop. She was walking up the driveway by the time Brad caught up with her.
What are you doing? He asked, trotting alongside her like a puppy.
Lena.
She stopped, putting her hand in her pocket.
Listen, Brad, just go back to the car.
She was two ranks above him. Technically, Brad was supposed to follow her orders. This thought seemed to cross his mind, but he shook his head no. He said,
This is Will Harris's place, isn't it?
Lena turned her back to him, continuing up the driveway. Will Harris's house was small, probably little more than 2 rooms and a bath. The clapboard was painted bright white, and the lawn was neatly tended. There was a well-tended look to the place that set Lena on edge. She could not think that the person who lived in this house could do such a thing to her sister. Lena knocked on the screen door. She could hear a television inside and distant movement. Through the screen mesh, she could see a man struggling to get out of his chair. He was wearing a white undershirt and white pajama pants. A puzzled expression was on his face. Unlike most people who worked in town, Lena wasn't a regular at the diner. Somewhere in the back of her mind, Lena had considered the diner Sybil's territory and hadn't wanted to intrude. Lena had never really met Will Harris. She had been expecting someone younger, someone more menacing. Will Harris was an old man. When he finally reached the door and saw Lena, his lips parted in surprise.
Neither spoke for a moment, then Will finally said,
"You must be her sister."
Lena stared at the old man. She knew in her gut that Will Harris had not killed her sister. But there was still the possibility that he knew who had. She said,
"Yes, sir. Do you mind if I come in?"
The hinge on the screen door screeched as it opened. He stepped aside, holding the door open for Lena.
"You gotta excuse my appearance," he said, indicating his pajamas. "I wasn't exactly expecting visitors."
"That's okay," Lena offered, glancing around the small room. The living room and kitchen space were blended, a couch delineating the two. There was a square hallway off the left through which Lena could see a bathroom. She guessed the bedroom was on the other side of the wall. Like the outside of the house, everything was neat and tidy. Well cared for, despite its age. A television dominated the living room. Surrounding the set were wall-to-wall bookcases, packed with videos.
"I like to watch a lot of movies," Will said.
Lena smiled.
"Obviously." "Mostly I like the old black and white ones,"
the old man started, then turned his head toward the large picture window lining the front of the room.
"Lord almighty," he mumbled. "I seem to be real popular today."
Lena suppressed a groan as Jeffrey Tolliver walked up the driveway. Either Brad had told on her, or Pete Wayne had fingered Will.
"Morning, sir,"
Will said, opening the screen door for Jeffrey. Jeffrey gave him a nod, then shot Lena the kind of look that made her palms sweat. Will seemed to sense the tension in the room.
"I can go in the back if you need."
Jeffrey turned to the old man and shook his hand.
"No need, Will," he said. "I just need to ask you a few questions."
Will indicated the couch with a sweep of his hand.
"Mind if I get me some more coffee?"
"No, sir," Jeffrey answered, walking past Lena toward the couch. He fixed her with the same hard look, but Lena sat beside him anyway. Will shuffled back to his chair, groaning as he sat. His knees popped, and he smiled apologetically, explaining,
"Spend most of my days on my knees in the yard."
Jeffrey took out his notebook. Lena could almost feel the anger coming off of him.
"Will, I've got to ask you some questions." "Yes, sir."
"You know what happened at the diner yesterday." Will placed his coffee cup down on a small side table.
"That girl never hurt nobody," he said. "What was done to her?"
He stopped, looking at Lena.
"My heart goes out to you and your family, sweetheart. It really does."
Lena cleared her throat.
"Thank you."
Jeffrey had obviously been expecting a different response from her. His look changed, but she couldn't make out what he was thinking. He turned back to Will.
"You were at the diner until what time yesterday?" "Oh, around 1:30 or a little before 2, I think. I saw your sister," he told Lena, "just as I was leaving."
Jeffrey waited a few beats, then said,
"You're sure about that?" "Oh, yes, sir,"
Will returned.
"I had to go pick up my auntie at the church. They get out of choir practice at 2:15 sharp. She don't like to wait."
Lena asked, "Where does she sing?"
"The AME over in Madison," he answered. "You ever been there?"
She shook her head, doing the math in her head. Even if Will Harris had been a viable suspect, there was no way he could have killed Sybil, then made it to Madison in time to pick up his aunt. A quick phone call would give Will Harris an airtight alibi.
"Will," Jeffrey began, "I hate to ask you about this, but my man Frank says there was some problem a while back."
Will's face dropped. He had been looking at Lena up until this point, but now he stared at the carpet.
Yes, sir, that's right.
He looked over Jeffrey's shoulder as he spoke.
My wife, Eileen. I used to go at her something bad. I guess it was before your time we got into a scuffle, maybe 18, 19 years ago.
He shrugged.
She left me after that. I guess I let the drink lead me down the wrong path, but I'm a good Christian man now. I don't go in for all that. I don't see my son much, but I see my daughter often as I can. She lives in Savannah now.
His smile came back.
I got 2 grandbabies.
Jeffrey tapped his pen on the notebook. Lena could see over his shoulder that he had not written anything. He asked,
Did you ever take Sybil her meals? In the diner, I mean.
If he was surprised by the question, Will didn't let it register.
Well, I guess I did. Most days I helped Pete out with things like that. His daddy kept a woman around to wait tables when he was running the place, but Pete, he said, chuckling, old Pete, he can hold on to a dollar.
Will waved his hand, dismissing the trouble.
It don't hurt me none to fetch some ketchup or make sure somebody gets their coffee.
Jeffrey asked, Did you serve Sybil tea?
Sometimes. Is there a problem?
Jeffrey closed his notebook.
Not at all, he said. Did you see anyone suspicious hanging around the diner yesterday? Lord God, Will breathed. I surely would have told you by now. It was just me and Pete there and all the regulars for lunch. Thank you for your time.
Jeffrey stood, and Lena followed suit. Will shook first Jeffrey's, then Lena's hand. He held onto hers a little longer, saying,
God bless you, girl. You take care now.
God damn it, Lena, Jeffrey cursed, slamming his notebook into the dashboard of the car. The pages fluttered out, and Lena held her hands up in front of her to keep from getting whacked in the head.
What the hell were you thinking?
Lena picked up the notebook off the floor.
I wasn't thinking, she answered.
No fucking joke, he snapped, grabbing the notebook. His jaw was a tight line as he backed the car out of Will Harris's driveway. Frank had gone back to the station with Brad while Lena had been practically thrown into Jeffrey's car. He bumped the gear on the steering wheel column and the car jerked into drive.
Why can't I trust you?
He demanded.
Why can't I trust you to do one thing I tell you to do?
He did not wait for her answer.
I sent you out with Brad to do something, Lena. I gave you a job on this investigation because you asked me, not because I thought you were in any position to do it. And what's my reward for this? I've got Frank and Brad seeing you go behind my back like some teenager sneaking out of the house. Are you a fucking cop or are you a fucking kid?
He slammed on the brakes, and Lena felt her seatbelt cutting into her chest. They were stopped in the middle of the road, but Jeffrey did not seem to notice.
Look at me, he said, turning to her.
Lena did as she was told, trying to keep the fear out of her eyes. Jeffrey had been mad at her plenty of times, but never like this. If she had been right about Will Harris, Lena might have had a leg to stand on. As it was, she was screwed.
You have got to get your head on straight. Do you hear me?
She gave a sharp nod.
I can't have you going around behind my back. What if he had done something to you?
He let that sink in.
What if Will Harris is the man who killed your sister? What if he opened his door, saw you, and freaked out?
Jeffrey slammed his fist into the steering wheel, hissing another curse.
You have got to do what I say, Lena. Is that clear from now on?
He jabbed his finger in her face.
If I tell you to interview every aunt on the playground, you bring me back signed depositions on each one. Is that clear?
She managed to nod again.
Yeah.
Jeffrey wasn't satisfied. Is that clear, detective?
Yes, sir, Lena repeated.
Jeffrey put the car back into gear. The tires caught as he accelerated, leaving a good deal of rubber on the road. Both hands gripped the wheel so hard that his knuckles were white. Lena kept quiet, hoping his anger would pass. He had every right to be pissed. But she did not know what to say. An apology seemed as useless as treating a toothache with honey. Jeffrey rolled his window down, loosening his tie. Suddenly he said,
I don't think Will did it.
Lena nodded her head up and down, afraid to open her mouth. Even if he did have this episode in his past, Jeffrey began, anger coming back into his voice.
Frank failed to mention that this thing with his wife was 20 years ago.
Lena was silent.
Anyway, Jeffrey waved this off. Even if he had it in him, he's at least 60, maybe 70 years old. He couldn't even get into his chair, let alone overpower a healthy 33-year-old woman.
Jeffrey continued.
So that leaves us with Pete in the diner, right?
He didn't wait for her answer. He was obviously just thinking out loud.
Only I called Tessa on the way over here. She got there a little before 2 o'clock. Will was gone, and Pete was the only one there. She said Pete stayed behind the cash register until she placed her order, then he grilled her burger.
Jeffrey shook his head.
He might have slipped into the back, but when? When did he have time? That'd take, what, 10, 15 minutes? Plus the planning? How did he know it would work out?
Again, these questions seemed rhetorical.
And we all know Pete. I mean, Jesus. This isn't the kind of thing a first-timer would pull.
He was silent, obviously still thinking. And Lena left him alone. She stared out the window, processing what Jeffrey had said about Pete Wayne and Will Harris. An hour ago, these two men had looked like good suspects to her. Now there was nobody. Jeffrey was right to be angry at her. She could have been out with Brad, tracking down the men on their list, maybe finding the man who had killed Sybil. Lena's eyes focused on the houses they were driving by. At the turn, she checked the street sign, noting that they were on Cooper.
Jeffrey asked, You think Nan will be home?
Lena shrugged. The smile he gave her said he was trying.
You can talk now, you know.
Her lips came up, but she couldn't quite return the smile.
Thanks.
Then,
I'm sorry about...
He held up his hand to stop her.
You're a good cop, Lena. You're a damn good cop.
He pulled the car to the curb in front of Nan and Sybil's house.
You just need to start listening.
I know.
No, you don't.
He said, but he did not seem angry anymore.
Your whole life has turned upside down, and you don't even know it yet.
She started to speak, then stopped.
Jeffrey said, I understand needing to work on this, needing to keep your mind occupied, but you've got to trust me on this, Lena. If you ever cross that line with me again, I will bust you so low you'll be fetching coffee for Brad Stevens. Is that clear?
She managed to nod her head.
Okay,
he said, opening the car door.
Let's go.
Lena took her time taking off her seatbelt. She got out of the car, adjusting her gun and holster as she walked toward the house. By the time she reached the front door, Nan had already let Jeffrey in.
Hey,
Lena offered.
Hey,
Nan returned. She was holding a ball of tissue in her hand, the same as she had been last night. Her eyes were puffy, and her nose was bright red.
Hey,
Hank said. Lena stopped.
What are you doing here?
Hank shrugged, rubbing his hands together. He was wearing a sleeveless t-shirt, and the needle tracks up his arms were on full display. Lena felt a rush of embarrassment. She had only seen Hank in Reese, where everybody knew about his past. She had seen the scar so many times that she had almost blocked them out. Now she was seeing them through Jeffrey's eyes for the first time, and she wanted to run from the room. Hank seemed to be waiting for Lena to say something. She stumbled, managing an introduction. "This is Hank Norton, my uncle," she said. "Jeffrey Tolliver, chief of police." Hank held out his hand, and Lena cringed to see the raised scars on his forearms. Some of them were half an inch long in places, where he had jabbed the needle into his skin, looking for a good vein. Hank said, "How do you do, sir?" Jeffrey took the offered hand, giving it a firm shake. "I'm sorry we had to meet under these circumstances." Hank clasped his hands in front of him. "Thank you for that." They were all silent. Then Jeffrey said, "I guess you know why we're here." "About Sybil," Nan answered, her voice a few octaves lower, probably from crying all night. "Right," Jeffrey said, indicating the sofa. He waited for Nan to sit, then took the space beside her. Lena was surprised when he took Nan's hand and said, "I'm so sorry for your loss, Nan." Tears welled into Nan's eyes. She actually smiled. "Thank you." "We're doing everything we can to find out who did this," he continued. "I want you to know if there's anything else you need, we're here for you." She whispered another thank you, looking down, picking at the string on her sweatpants. Jeffrey asked, "Was anybody angry at you or Sybil, do you know?"
"No," Nan answered. "I told Lena last night everything's been the same as usual lately."
"I know that Sybil and you chose to live kind of quietly," Jeffrey said. Lena got his meaning. He was being a lot more subtle than she had been last night.
"Yeah," Nan agreed. "We like it here. We're both small-town people."
Jeffrey asked, "You can't think of anybody who might have figured something out?" Nan shook her head. She looked down, her lips trembling. There was nothing else she could tell him. "Okay," he said, standing. He put his hand on Nan's shoulder, indicating she should stay seated. "I'll let myself out." He reached into his pocket and brought out a card. Lena watched as he cupped it in one hand and wrote on the back. "This is my home number," he said. "Call me if you think of anything."
"Thank you,"
Nan said, taking the card. Jeffrey turned to Hank. "Do you mind giving Lena a ride home?" Lena felt dumbstruck. She couldn't stay here. Hank was obviously taken aback as well. "No," he mumbled. "That's fine." "Good." He patted Nan on the shoulder, then said to Lena, "You and Nan can take tonight to put together a list of the people Sybil worked with." Jeffrey gave Lena a knowing smile. "Be at the station at 7 tomorrow morning. We'll go over to the college before classes start." Lena didn't understand. "Am I back with Brad?" He shook his head. "You're with me." Wednesday. Chapter 11. Ben Walker, the chief of police before Jeffrey, had kept his office in the back of the station, just off the briefing room. A desk the size of an upended commercial refrigerator was in the center of the room with a row of uncomfortable chairs in front of it. Every morning, the men on the senior squad were called into Ben's office to hear their assignments for the day. Then they left, and the chief shut his door. What Ben did from this time until 5 o'clock
when he could be seen scooting down the street to the diner for his supper, was a mystery. Jeffrey's first task when he took over Ben's job was to move his office to the front of the squad room. Using a skill saw, Jeffrey cut a hole in the sheetrock and installed a glass picture window so that he could sit at his desk and see his men and, more important, so that his men could see him. There were blinds on the window, but he never closed them. And for the most part, his office door was always open. 2 days after Sybil Adams' body had been found, Jeffrey sat in his office, reading a report that Marla had just handed him. Nick Shelton at the GBI had been kind enough to rush through the analysis on the box of tea. Results. It was tea. Jeffrey scratched his chin, looking around his office. It was a small room, but he had built a set of bookshelves into one of the walls in order to keep things neat. Field manuals and statistical reports were stacked alongside marksman trophies he had won at the Birmingham competitions and assigned team football from when he had played at Auburn. Not that he really played. Jeffrey had spent most of his time on the bench, watching the other players build careers for themselves. A photograph of his mother was tucked into the far corner of the shelf. She was wearing a pink blouse and holding a small wrist corsage in her hands. The photo was taken at Jeffrey's high school graduation. He had caught his mother giving one of her rare smiles in front of the camera. Her eyes were lit up, probably with the possibilities she saw in front of her son. That he had dropped out of Auburn a year from graduation and taken a job on the Birmingham police force was something she still had not forgiven her only child for. Marla tapped on his office door, holding a cup of coffee in one hand and a donut in the other. On Jeffrey's first day, she told him that she had never fetched coffee for Ben Walker, and she wasn't about to fetch it for him. Jeffrey had laughed. The thought had never occurred to him. Marla had been bringing him his coffee ever since.
"The donut's for me," she said, handing him the paper cup. "Nick Shelton's on line 3.
"Thank you," he said, waiting for her to leave. Jeffrey sat back in his chair as he picked up the phone. "Nick?" Nick's southern drawl came across the line.
"How you?"
"Not so great," Jeffrey answered.
"I hear you,"
Nick returned. Then,
"Got my report?"
"On the tea?" Jeffrey picked up the sheet of paper, looking over the analysis. For such a simple beverage, a lot of chemicals went into processing tea.
"It's just cheap store-bought tea, right?"
"You got it," Nick said.
"Listen, I tried to call Sarah this morning, but I couldn't find her."
"That's so." Nick gave a low chuckle.
"You're never gonna forgive me for asking her out that time, are you, buddy?"
Jeffrey smiled.
"Nope. One of my drug people here at the lab is hot on this belladonna. Not many cases come in, and he volunteered to give you guys a face-to-face rundown."
"That'd be an awfully big help," Jeffrey said. He saw Lena through the glass window and waved her in.
"Sarah talking to you this week?"
Nick didn't wait for an answer.
"My guy's gonna want to talk to her about how the victim presented."
Jeffrey bit back the cutting remark that wanted to come, forcing some cheerfulness into his voice as he said,
"How about around 10 tomorrow?"
Jeffrey was noting the meeting on his calendar when Lena walked in. As soon as he looked up, she began speaking.
"He doesn't do drugs anymore."
"What?"
"At least I don't think so."
Jeffrey shook his head, not understanding.
"What are you talking about?"
She lowered her voice, saying,
"My Uncle Hank."
She held her forearms out to him.
"Oh."
Jeffrey finally got it. He had not been sure if Hank Norton was a past drug addict or had been in a disfiguring fire. His arms were so scarred.
"Yeah, I saw they were old."
she said,